Today, millions of American kids receive up to half their daily calories in their schools. Childhood obesity has become a major national health concern, and many school systems are looking at their meal programs to help reverse the epidemic. Chef Tony Garaci, the former food services director at Baltimore City Schools and now executive director at Memphis City Schools Nutrition Services, has transformed cafeteria menus by sourcing fresh foods from local farms, creating menus with students, and he has expanded school meal participation by adding breakfast and supper programs. A new documentary called Cafeteria Man gives us a behind-the-scenes look at the battles he's had to wage to bring healthier and more sustainable foods into public schools. It airs next week, September 13th at 3 p.m. on WNET here in New York, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tony Garaci to our show now. Hi.
Hey, Leonard.
How did you first become involved with Baltimore City Schools? What had you done before?
So I was a former food service director in New Hampshire, and I started doing kind of innovative things like treating the kids like the clients that they are and talking to them about food and about their choices and what they would like and what they would like to see. And what I found universally was if you give kids an opportunity to participate in the change, they're willing participants.
Well, critics often say that this is just a version of nanny state taking over people's lives. But in this story, the kids themselves had requested a change.
Yeah, so the story went, so this group of kids went to the school board meeting and they brought school lunch with them and they flipped the trays upside down and nothing fell off the trays. And then they invited the school board to try lunch. Nobody wanted to try lunch. And that began the catalyst of change.
It was pizza. And why was pizza such a popular item on the school menus? The kids complained that they were served reheated pizza every day of the week.
Yeah, it was horrible, okay? And I think what happens is a lot of school nutrition programs sort of look at the cheapest way to sort of get out of it, right? So they understand that, you know, this is a requirement that we have to do, so let's just do whatever we have to do to get past the requirement without the thought of the end product. Look,
pizza gives you grain, it gives you a vegetable, and it gives you a protein with the cheese.
Exactly. But if you get it every day of the week, you get burnt out and you get sick of it, right?
So this was just a budgetary matter?
A lot of it had to do with that, and a lot of it had to do with just people's perceptions about food. So I grew up in New Orleans. I grew up in a city that names its highways after chefs, you know? So food is celebrated there. And I'm also one of the founders of the National Farm to School movement. And I know when you give a kid a seed and let them plant that seed and watch it grow and so they can harvest and prepare whatever was grown and serve it to their peers, it forever changes the way they look at food. It's no longer a consumptive act.
But when you began, weren't some of the students unfamiliar with even the most common fruits and vegetables? Some, as pointed out in the film, had never even eaten a fresh peach before.
Yeah.
Had they only eaten canned peaches?
If that. So I've dedicated my work in big urban markets where kids don't often get access to real food. All right. So if you go to certain neighborhoods, like they'll tell you that Doritos or Cheetos and a Mountain Dew is food, right? Because those are their reference points. So
Ronald Reagan said ketchup was a vegetable.
Exactly. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to recreate reference points around real food and then let them draw their own conclusions.
In similar attempts around the country, haven't students resisted the new foods, especially fresh green vegetables?
Some. Look, so my grandmother lived to be 102, and one of her favorite phrases to me was, "Antonio, eat your greens and go out and play," right? So, you know, this is an old truth, you know, that we're trying to reinstill.
Where does the money for these school lunches, lunches later, you've expanded it. Where does it come from? Is it from the city budget or is...
No. It's all federal USDA reimbursed dollars. So these are your federal tax dollars that are wicked away. And the only way that you get those federal dollars back is you have to go out and get them and bring them back. So in Memphis, we just launched the largest no charge child nutrition program. And I say no charge, not free. All right. Because there is a cost to it. But for every meal that I serve, I get reimbursed by the Fed to serve that meal.
Why doesn't everybody do that?
Because people often don't connect the dots. So I run a $90 million a year business. I'm a businessman, but the product that I produce are healthy kids sitting in front of educators ready to learn. The byproduct is the food on the tray. The byproduct is the method of how I get it on the tray.
When you say no charge as opposed to free, you mean you're not charging the kids, but it is.
Correct.
But of course, it doesn't come to you free.
Right. Correct. So I still have to buy that food. I still have to pay staffing. I still have to maintain kitchens.
In the film, you get the sense that the bureaucracy is a major problem, that they
are
so used
problem.
To buying it a certain way. Maybe there are even some kickbacks that's not mentioned. But there are all sorts of reasons why there's resistance through the whole system to just doing what may very well be less expensive and a lot more nutritional.
Right. And you hit it right on the head, Leonard, in that there are people that make a business of wicking money away from these programs. And when you identify them, I had an instance where I was kind of auditing some of our process and procedure, and I said, why am I paying $7 a case to move product that I already own from this side of the warehouse to that side of the warehouse? And I was told to shut up, you know? And then I started kind of digging deeper into it, and as it turns out, somebody was getting about $1.2 million a year that they were splitting up amongst this cohort of people. And it was all your money, and the kids got pizza every day.
You started a farm. It was behind some auto shops,
yeah.
Auto supply shops. Was that land just sitting fallow in Baltimore?
Yeah, so it was the genesis of the farm was there was this gentleman, Reverend George Bragg. He was a slave. And even though the Emancipation Proclamation had been proclaimed, he understood that his people would never experience freedom until they had economic freedom. So what he did, he was given this 40-acre plot.
But not a mule.
But it had granite and a bunch of other stuff on the land. And these kids quarried the stone, built these beautiful buildings, and during the Great Depression, like a lot of things went under, and the city took it over, the school district got it, and then a group of individuals told me about this place, and I went out and just reclaimed it.
Were the students initially interested in learning how to farm, or was that a hard sell?
No, it wasn't a hard sell, and I think that we underestimate what kids are willing to do and what kids are interested in. We have a preconceived notion that like they only want to work with tech widgets and things like that, and they're not interested in going out and playing and doing any of these
things.
Well,
there has been a movement around the country. Alice Waters in California.
Sure.
In New York, there are a lot of schools where the kids are growing things in the old playgrounds or on their rooftops.
Yeah.
And they get really involved. But you were trying to do it on a larger scale, weren't you? A real farm here.
Well,
who paid for that?
So I leveraged that through USDA and reimbursement for the meals that I was serving. I had the one thing I didn't have was any dollar monetary support from the school district. They said, Tony, you can do whatever you want to do, but we can't pay for it. So you need to figure that out. Coming from New Orleans, I employed the Blanche DuBois School of Business and relied upon the kindness of strangers, to sort of bring this conversation forward.
Well, that's what often happens in the local schools like the ones in New York. The PTAs get involved, but in poorer schools, the kids don't get that opportunity. Yeah.
You guys are really fortunate here in New York. You have a new food service director. He's been here, I think, like 18 months now. His name is Dennis Barrett. He's an old dear friend of mine. He was the former director in Los Angeles and also in Anchorage. He's an innovator. He's a mover and a shaker. He was brought here specifically to make these changes happen.
My guest is Tony Garesi, who is the subject of a film called Cafeteria Man, which will be airing on September 13th at 3 p.m. on NET. I wish it were being broadcast later at night, because this is a fabulous film. It really does reveal just how difficult it is to get the most simple things done in our system once the bureaucracy is entrenched. You planned on building a central kitchen in for Baltimore City schools. The way it's generally done is the meals are cooked in the schools themselves, aren't they? What
Correct.
Would the central kitchen have done to make it better?
So I have a central kitchen in Memphis, right? So the central kitchen really is not about cooking the meals. All of our schools have cooking capable kitchens. What we do is we prepare and deliver cafeteria ready products. So instead of having them wash and chop up vegetables and, you know, do all of that side work, I do that for them. So now they're ready to put it in their steamer and serve it. I do the mother sauces there. They complete it at the school.
And that makes it a lot easier for them to prepare all the meals they need to prepare.
And it helps you to leverage your purchasing power and consistency and quality.
But it never happened in Baltimore.
No, and it was really funny. There was an entrepreneur who stepped up and said, I will build a central kitchen. I will lease it to the city for $1 a year for 8 years so he could take the federal tax credits off the deal. And then I'll sell it to you for 50 cents. And what happened was it got so embroiled in politics that they kept fighting over what part of the town that it was going to be in. So finally last year, the guy just said, I'm selling the property.
You also created Meatless Mondays for school lunches. Did all the schools join in on that?
Yeah, every school did, and it was really funny because I am not a vegetarian, but why I wanted to do Meatless Mondays was to begin a conversation about eating differently.
And then you say you received angry letters from the American Meat Association. Actually, you say hate mail.
Look. The Nebraska Beef Council sent a cowboy to my office dressed in chaps and like hat, regalia, and stuff like that. And he was ready to rope and tie me. And I said, look, come with me to my farm and then I'll tell you what I'm doing. He spent the afternoon with me at the farm and he said, oh, this has nothing to do with meat. This has everything to do with local and everything to do with getting kids to do it. And the guy's name is Trent Luce and he's a syndicated talk show host. And he actually did a very positive piece afterwards, but he had to see what was going on.
But you were still disinvited to the White House for an event there, probably because of the pressure that was put on it.
Yeah.
Later, you were honored at the White House. Yeah. And Sam Kass, the White House's senior policy advisor for nutrition policy, came down to Baltimore.
Yeah, came to the Great Kids Farm along with Secretary of Education people from the USDA. It was quite a to-do.
J. Keith Scroggins, the COO of Baltimore City Public Schools, said that his job was to slow you down.
Yeah. So, I think it goes back to recognizing that some of the paradigms within public school systems are broken. So let's and people cling desperately to that paradigm. And he's one of those guys.
One of the kids who started the ball rolling, this brilliant young woman,
Alice,
who I think is going to wind up being president of the United States, she testified before a congressional committee calling for changes in federal policy. Has anything happened?
Yeah, a great deal has happened. And I want to say something about that. This was the first time in American history that a child got to testify about a law that directly affected them. And she spoke for the children of America, and she did a very eloquent job of it. The Authorization Act that rolled out of there has made the broadest changes within the guidelines that this country has ever seen. There is a movement afoot right now to undermine that. And I have to say, the School Nutrition Association, which I'm an active member of, I don't agree with all of their policies, is trying to roll it back. I think we have to stop lowering the bar. We've got to, you know, if you see a drowning person, you don't jump in and drown with them. You throw them a line to help them.
So Memphis has been more encouraging.
Yeah,
when you speak to people in other cities, you mentioned New York has a good policy, but when you speak to people in other cities in those jobs, are you finding them all pretty much frustrated?
You know, it's like a 50-50 mix. There are a lot of really innovative food service directors that get it, that want to make the changes and that are actively working to make those changes. There are a lot of people that are entrenched, you know, the kind of blue-haired lunch lady that is not really interested in that. They're interested in what the Pepsi guy is going to kick back to them.
On the other hand, you found also many local farmers who would have been very happy to have supplied the schools at prices that were a lot lower than the schools were paying.
Right. And again, that's about the procurement policy and procedure. And a lot of farmers would not even bid on the product because they looked at the RFP and they said, oh, this is too crazy. I can't figure it out. But we've managed to take that apart and dissect it and give it to farmers a little bite at a time, where we've created aggregation systems where 40 farmers can work together.
Have you found that obesity rates are lower in Memphis than they are in Baltimore?
I think they're probably about the same. And I think that Memphis is certainly one of those Mid-South cities that, you know, if they could fry water, they would, you know. So look, I grew up in New Orleans, so I can't, like, throw stones at this thing at all, you know?
I like that frying water. I tried it once. It just came up in a lot of bubbles.
Yeah.
Tony Gracie is the subject of a film called Cafeteria Man. How did this film get made?
Richard Chisholm and Sheila Kincaid, their local Baltimore people, came to my office one day, and they had read an article that came out in the Washington Post about, you know, starting this farm and doing some other stuff. And Richard is a filmmaker and also did most of the camera work for the HBO series The Wire. He kind of came because he was waiting for it to fail and wanted to document it. But as it turned out, we became very good friends.
And Baltimore's in the arts these days. Yesterday we had John Waters on our show.
He's brilliant. Done
things on The Wire. And now Tony Gracie featured in Cafeteria Man, which airs September 13th at 3 p.m. on WNET.